Oh, when you smiling, when you smiling, the whole world smiles with you, baby. Yes, when you laughing. When you're laughing, yes, the sun comes shining through. But when you're crying, you bring on the rain. So stop your singing, baby, and be happy.
Hi, good morning. Good morning. Good morning. Morning. Hi, hi, hi. So welcome. So I see the upstairs is open now. The reason why we had it closed was because, you know, this class is getting a bad reputation. You know, people say, well, it's a touchy-feely class, so I wanted to live up to our reputation, have everyone sit down here together. You know, when you have a reputation, you should exploit it to the end. So I'd like to welcome a group of ex-students, ex-Harvard students, who are now doing wonderful work with Teach for America, an organization that I strongly and heartedly support. In fact, Wendy Kopp, who is the founder and president of Teach for America, is going to be a guest lecturer in my other class on leadership. I'm going to announce that, so obviously you're all invited to that. But judging by the numbers that came in this morning, you're all taking 1508 as well. So I don't need to invite you especially for that. But without further ado, Teach for America.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. I want to start by thanking Professor Ben Shahar for letting us come speak to you today. My name's Julie Kobik, and I graduated last year. When I was at Harvard, I was involved in the Institute of Politics and Harvard Model Congress, and now I'm teaching second grade in the Bronx.
And I'm Justin Chapa. I was also Harvard class. Thank you. Thank you. I'll be here all week. I was a government concentrator, and I lived in Foho, hide all the podlings. And now I'm teaching government and economics to seniors at Rivera High School in Brownsville, Texas.
So the reason why we're here to talk to you today is because children born into low-income areas are not getting the education that they deserve. And I want to share a statistic with you all that children who are born in low-income areas are 7 times less likely to graduate from college than their peers in high-income areas. I know a lot of you might have heard that statistic before, but I just want to do a quick demonstration to show you how that actually plays out in real life. So could everybody who's born between the first and the 15th of the month, please stand up for a second. Okay. If you look around, that looks like 50% of you. Now, if you were all born into families where your parents made a combined income of $90,000 in a year, this many of you standing would be the students who graduate from college, so about half of you. Now, could everyone who was born only the first and second of the month remain standing and everybody else sit down? Okay, so that's not too many of you, right? The people still standing are the people who would be going to college if you all were born into families who make a combined income of $35,000 or less in a year. And I think that's kind of a dramatic statistic. If you look around, I see maybe 10 people still standing. That's 1 in 15 people who are born into low-income areas will actually graduate college, and we think that statistic is unacceptable in a democratic nation. So.
And just to put that into real terms for you, I said I teach seniors in Brownsville, and so I'm helping a lot of my students with the college application process. And to make it personal, just to give you a story about a student that I had, this guy is a big guy. His name's Giovanni Matamoros, and he's about 6'3", 6'4", 240 pounds, huge football player. And he came to my class for economics last semester, and I had offered my students in the first day of class to help them with their college applications, and he came up to me after class, and he took me up on the offer. So I made a little deal with Gio, and every 6 weeks, I buy pizza for the kids in my class who get an A, and I told him if he would work towards getting that goal and getting to that pizza party, I'd have no problem helping him with his college applications. He said he wanted to be a dental hygienist. And the first 6 weeks, he didn't quite make the A. The second 6 weeks, he didn't quite make the A. But the third 6 weeks, he did. And at the end of the 6 weeks also, having worked with him all semester, he got into 4 schools. And I just want to put that into perspective, because when I first met Gio, I went and talked to some of his other teachers. And to a person, they told me that Giovanni was one of the laziest students that they had in their class. Having talked to him for the whole semester, I found out that when he got out of football practice at 7 o'clock each night, he went to a tire store and worked until closed, often working until 11 or 12 o'clock at night. And so that's why he seemed tired all the time. On the last day of the semester in December, I got a knock on my door in the middle of fourth period, and he sticks his head in. I told him to come to my class. He didn't want to come in my class, couldn't figure out why. So I finally went out in the hallway, and here's this 6'3", 6'4", 240-pound football player, and he's got something behind his back. And he didn't want to come to class to show the rest of the class. He had a Christmas present for me. And he gave me this huge bear hug. And I'm only 5'6". So this is an interesting situation. But that's what we're about here at Teach for America. We're about making a difference in people's lives who need that to be made. There are thousands, millions of Giovanni Matamoroses across the country. And that's what we're trying to do. I think at my time at Harvard, it was very easy to participate in public service, and it was very easy to mouth the words for public service. But I think Harvard's a place where it's very easy to do that here, and it's very easy to issue the calls and the call to arms, calls to action here. But I think very few of us outside of the ivy-covered walls want to step forward and make that commitment beyond our 4 years here. If you're the type of person, though, who is more interested in making the difference, answering the call, and not just giving the call to arms, then I think that you would be interested in joining us at Teach for America.
If you're interested, we have a couple different avenues for you to get more information. We have an info session tomorrow night from 8 to 10 at Tommy Doyle's in the square. Justin and I will be there, and there'll be 13 other Teach for America alumni, and we'd be very happy to talk to anyone, tell you how our year's been going. You can also log on to our website, which is www.teachforamerica.org. You can find out about the mission, how Teach for America has been doing, look at the application. I just want to remind everyone the application for this year is due February 17th, so it's a good time to log on now if you've been thinking about it. Thank you again very much for your time. Thank you, Professor Ben-Shahar, and we look forward to meeting with you.
Okay, thank you very much. All right, so the next two classes are about the basic premises of what this entire semester is about, what drives the thinking, and in many ways, the way I think about education in general, I do a lot of work on curriculum development and approaches to education. I think about education as a spiral where you start here, it could be in first grade or age 3 or wherever, and you build, or you build on that spiral. And you revisit points that you learn at the beginning simply at a higher level of the spiral. This class is about, or the next two classes, is the bottom of the spiral. And throughout the semester, we'll revisit these very ideas as the foundation. But before I go into this class, I want to just respond to something that one of the students brought up right after class. Daniel Valenti emailed me about this model. Do you remember the story about my girlfriend leaving me and then having that self-pity and so on versus this? And what Daniel brought up, and he said, and he's right, what do you mean confidence? I mean, how can you feel confidence after, and I quote, someone dumps you? And he's right, and I clarified, and I wanted to clarify to the whole class, I don't mean confidence in the general sense. I mean confidence about being able to bounce back. Resilience literally means to be able to bounce back. If I'm a passive victim, I don't have much confidence that I can bounce back, that I can find someone else, that I can succeed in school despite the terrible circumstances. Whereas if I'm an active agent, I'm much more confident. And then I also thought that maybe the word hope would be more appropriate instead of confidence. So you can either put, you know, confidence in my ability to bounce back or hoping that things will work out in the long run. And we're going to talk a lot about hope, about optimism throughout the course. It's one of the characteristics, core characteristics of the successful and happy individual, and we're going to talk about how we cultivate these things. So just wanted to say a few words about this. The premises, the foundation of the spiral of this semester. This class will go against what a lot of classes, a lot of academia is about, which is demarcation, division, and rather it will try to create bridges, bridges among disciplines, bridges among ideas. Remember I talked about the bridge created between the ivory tower and Main Street. Second premise, again, the reason why I'm teaching this class is because I believe change is possible. But this is not conventional wisdom in psychology today. Many people believe that change isn't possible, that we're basically stuck with our early upbringing, until the age of three, our genetic predisposition, and we're stuck with that for the rest of our lives with minor, insignificant deviations. I will argue that change is possible. Also, many people believe that if I only get this next stage, this job, this relationship, this amount of money, then I'll be happy, then I'll be fulfilled. You know, the rat race scenario. Well, what research shows is that that's not the case. That ultimately, happiness, well-being is determined by the internal, much more than the external. Not that the external doesn't matter. External circumstances do. But far less than we believe. It's only part of the equation of happiness. If you look at the history of ideas in general, philosophy, psychology, history, it's very much a debate between one side that believe that our nature is good and what we need to do is, as much as possible, obey it, versus people who believe that our nature is bad, we need to control it, we need to perfect it. I fall much more on this, what Francis Bacon said, nature to be commanded must be obeyed. I will make an argument for that. Again, it will become much clearer. We're going to get to that next week only. And the final thing we'll talk about is, should happiness be our end? Aristotle thinks so. Aristotle said that happiness is and ought to be the end of all our pursuits. But other people are saying no. It's narcissistic, selfish, unhelpful to ourselves, to society, if we have this approach. I will argue for the fact that happiness is and ought to be the ultimate end. And what I will argue is that it leads to a win-win situation, certainly for us, but also for society at large. So these are the basic premises that I will argue for. Let me begin with the first one. Again, in many circles, especially within academia, but also outside, there is a clear demarcation, clear boundaries between things. Specialization is the call. You know, the world has become so complex, so fast, that the only way to deal with it in a sane manner is to demarcate, whether it's into departments or into sub-departments, sub-ideas, sub-molecules. And while there is sometimes justification for it, very often it hurts more than it helps. I mentioned the disconnect between the ivory tower and Main Street, where pop psychology is read by the literally millions, hundreds of millions. You look at the bestsellers list, New York Times, self-help books. And on the other hand, we have rigorous, phenomenal academic literature that is read by very few people. And only a handful of academics are able to bridge the gap. You know, one of them is Professor Langer from the department here. Great writer, very accessible, and extremely rigorous. Another one is Dan Gilbert, whose work we'll talk about next time, who's coming out with a book which will be accessible to the person on the street, not necessarily to the academic, and also based on rigorous research. But it's rare. And it's important to create, to bridge. Because as philosopher Alfred North Whitehead said, the careful shielding of the university from the activities of the world around us is the best way to chill interest and to defeat progress. Celibacy does not suit a university. It must mate itself with action. Yep, it's all about sex. So, who said that? But now you're sitting here and you're asking yourself, okay, nice quote, you know, evocative, interesting, but I don't want to go into academia. I'm not interested in academia. Why should I care? What has this got to do with my life if I'm not going into academia? The answer is everything. Certainly it has to do with your life if you are going into academia, but even if you're not, it has everything to do with your life. Here is why. As many of you know, I was a resident tutor here after graduating for about 6 years in Leverett House. I spent many hours in the dining hall as an undergrad, as a graduate student, talking with fellow students, with my students about life. I was also the business tutor, so I did a lot of counseling for the students for the futures. And it was my favorite part. I mean, actually, that's the main reason I came here for grad school as opposed to going to another school, because I wanted to be a resident tutor. So, wonderful discussions, and what I was most impressed by was the sense of mission, the desire to do good, to improve their own lives and the lives of others that I encountered in so many of the students, the desire to make a difference. Widespread throughout with whomever I talked to. It was actually remarkable because many people said, well, I want to go into this job or that job in order to do good now, or others are saying, well, I want to make money first and then I want to contribute in some way. And many people do, research shows us, and I'll talk about it in a minute. So they weren't just saying it. You see, there are false stereotypes that we actually have about ourselves. One thing that psychology shows is that we don't always evaluate ourselves and our immediate surrounding adequately. Harvard students are generous. You know that there are over 1,800 students at Harvard who are working with PBHA. Many others or doing work to help others independent of PBHA. Upon graduation, many Harvard students go on, make a lot of money, and contribute to society. Again, I don't see them as two opposite sides of an extreme. They're two sides of the same coin. Contribute to society. In fact, in recent research at HBS, the capitalist school, 57% of graduates were on not-for-profit or social enterprise boards, contributing out of their own time. 57%, it would be much higher if you took away the younger generation, because the youngsters are still very busy in the rat race making money. Most of them then go on and contribute. Gives most of them, most of you, again, I think this is a good, you know, this research shows where you will probably be a few years from now, contribute money to charity. Millions and billions, and not just to the Harvard Endowment, way beyond that. There's also false stereotypes of Americans. So much criticism around the world about this country. That Americans, you know, are too individualistic, selfish in the negative sense of the word. Americans give by far more than any other people in the world. A, because they're wealthier. B, because they want to do good, because they're generous. So even if you control for wealth, they still give disproportionately. Research by Phyllis Moen, M-O-E-N, from Cornell University, shows that Americans on average volunteer 4 hours a week, more by far than any other people in the world. If we have these stereotypes. So we certainly have goodwill there. And many of you in the future will go on to influential positions. You will influence people as a CEO. You will have influence on other people as a board member. You will have influence on other people as a donor. But there's a problem, and here comes the problem. You see, I meet so many Harvard grads, alums, who come here and talk to me and say, you know, I've joined this board, I've done this work, I do this in my own organization, and I'm dissatisfied. I'm dissatisfied because I feel that I'm not fulfilling my potential or the potential of the organization. I don't have the tools to do it. Very often, as we mentioned, they have the intentions. The intentions are certainly there, but they don't have the know-how how to translate these good intentions, this idealism, into practice. Goodwill and idealism are necessary but not sufficient. And while Harvard may create this idealism and goodwill, certainly doesn't, or not enough, provide the tools to use it. And we fall short of our potential. And people say, well, we need to throw more money into these projects. Whether, again, inner cities, where what we see is that it doesn't actually help. And then Marva Collins comes and shows us there's another way of doing it. Or Wendy Kopp comes and shows us there's a better way of doing it through Teach for America. We need to create a bridge here between the goodwill and the practicality, the know-how. And that's the role of psychology, or academia in general, as I see it. This is the role of this class. Because there is a lot of applied research. The problem, though, with the applied research is that it's not known. Not enough people know about it. Not enough people have access to it. Because remember, the average academic journal is read by how many people? Right. By 7 people. Not enough. How many people outside in the world, again, good people with good intentions, know about the Pygmalion in the classroom experiments that show that if you communicate beliefs in your students, these beliefs become self-fulfilling prophecy, and you can actually raise students' IQ levels if you communicate to them that you believe in them. As a lot of the teachers in Teach for America show, as Marva Collins shows, with the unteachable students. Marva Collins knows about the Pygmalion in the classroom. She lives it. But how many teachers know about this experiment? From my experience, very few, because I've given many talks to teachers. In fact, I see it as one of my central missions, is to get more people to know about Marva Collins and to get more people to know about the research done in the classroom. Because there are idealists, but they don't know about this research. And that's unfortunate. Or how many people know about the fantastic work done for increasing self-esteem by people like Albert Bandura from Stanford University, or Nathaniel Brandon, whom you're reading? Self-esteem is the buzzword today. But how do you increase self-esteem? Well, according to a lot of teachers and a lot of impractical idealists, it's by showering students with praise. Tell them how wonderful they are. Give them positive feedback. It will increase their self-esteem, and then they'll be better students and happier and so on. Yes, self-esteem increases performance in school. Yes, self-esteem increases levels of happiness. But you don't increase a person's self-esteem by showering them with praise indiscriminately. In the long run, you hurt them. But how many idealists know that? Marva Collins does. Yes, she gives them positive feedback. But does she make them work hard? The hard love, tough love kind of thing. Bandura shows that when people work hard and succeed as a result of that hard work, their self-esteem will increase, which will make them work harder, which will increase their self-esteem and success, and so on in a positive spiral. Not enough people, not enough teachers know about this, not enough individuals know about this. Because you know, growing up, and I'll talk about it much more when I talk about self-esteem, I thought that all I needed to do to increase my self-esteem was do well. So I did well. I was a top athlete, I was a top student, I got so much praise, I can't even tell you. But my self-esteem was low, and I didn't get it. Why? I did everything right, I thought. Because people don't know that this is not how you increase self-esteem in the long run. Yeah, positive praise is important, feedback is important, but it's not enough. We'll talk about what is enough throughout the semester. One of the central topics we'll address. How about the mind-body realm? Overcoming depression and anxiety. How many people know that meditation or yoga as a form of meditation can actually help one overcome anxiety and depression and rewire the way the brain works? Rewire the way the brain works by meditating. There's research, you know, yoga done in with criminals in jail that actually makes it less likely that there'll be repeat offenders. Can you imagine criminals doing yoga? Well, they do. They did. Practical idealism. Naive, right? Practical idealism. Or how about this? The research in conflict resolution, a lot of it. Already 50 years ago, with the work of Sharif, we know that it's not enough when you have a conflict for the people to just get together and resolve their differences and live happily ever after. You know, initially that's what they thought. It's called the contact hypothesis. Just bring people in touch with each other, in contact, and they'll resolve the conflicts. But what research has shown is that it just doesn't work. It's not enough. It's a first step, but what you need, according to Sharif and subsequent research, is a superordinate goal. What does that mean? A goal that you will work on together. Something where you will work interdependently, where you will be dependent on one another for the completion of that goal. Then, over time, prejudice will reduce, animosity will reduce, you will like each other much more. But where are the practical idealists who are applying this? Look at my country. Look at what's happening there. when people said, just get together into a room and you can resolve a 50-year conflict. Didn't happen. And because there are not enough practical idealists, people are dying. So there are real consequences to it. This is not just, oh, would be nice to read about the Sharif work. No, this is a life and death decision that people are making, especially many of you are going to go into politics, going into teaching. You'll have an impact on other people's lives and on your lives. And that's where psychology, that's when research, applied research, comes in and can help. Again, you know, you can read this research that you read and say, okay, it's going to be on the final exam, I need to remember it, but it's much more than that. It's much more than that because it is our responsibility to, as you know, having the privilege of this education, to take these ideas and apply them. Whether you're a manager in an investment bank, or whether you're a teacher or a parent, these are practical ideas. That's why I talked about at the beginning about active note-taking as opposed to passive note-taking. If you come up with an idea, okay, I can apply this to my life, write it down. Or I want to talk to my, you know, my dad about this. Write it down. This is when it will make it most, have most of an impact on you and also on other people. This class, as I think you've already gotten a sense, is interdisciplinary. It won't just focus on social psychology, for instance. It will draw on clinical psychology, cognitive psychology, neuroscience, biology, philosophy, positive psychology, obviously, history, and so on. Why? Because learning is better that way. There's a lot of research down here at the Ed School, a lot of it by Howard Gardner, but other people as well, that shows that we learn better when we take from different areas, different styles of learning. There isn't just a single style of learning. Now, it means that once in a while, I'm gonna talk about things that you're not really gonna connect to. It's not gonna be meaningful to you. But it will also mean that overall, the class has more likelihood of appealing to more people. Won't please everyone all of the time, but more people more of the time. Also, creativity. Creativity doesn't come when we focus, when we zoom in on just one area and go into depth there. Creativity comes when we, through lateral thinking. I mean, take, for example, Niels Bohr, the great physicist. He came up with the structure of the atom. You know when he came up with it? When he was playing his violin. He was a musician, too. And he realized that the distances, proportion between the notes are similar to the proportions on the structure of the atom. From music to physics, or look at Einstein, one of the greatest physicists. His ideas in physics didn't come from within physics. They came from geometry. They came from, you know, just from his imagination, you know, thinking about riding a light beam. The great ideas come from outside, not from within. This is why there are so many great ideas that come from minorities, from the outside. Not from within. Lateral thinking, bringing, whether it's bridging different cultures that we get great ideas, or whether it's bridging different disciplines. Also, reality is not demarcated. Reality is not specialized. You know, a human being, just look at yourself. You're biological, you're psychological, you're philosophical, you're ideological, you're all these things in one. I don't think we're doing justice to reality when we just say, okay, well, let's just use your head now. Well, now let's just use your heart. We want to be true to reality. And what is, and reality comprises both the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, as well as Will and Grace. This is what reality is about. And finally, I find it much more interesting to look at different areas. And when we're interested in material, we also learn it better, going back to the first point. So this is the first premise. This class will be interdisciplinary. It will not just focus on one area. And there is a challenge here. It's not just, okay, wow, great, fantastic, perfect. There's a challenge. Because there's also benefit to specialization. I would argue, especially in the sciences, much more so than in the social sciences or in the humanities. But there's certainly benefit. And our challenge, our meaning yours and mine, is to be able to bring this interdisciplinary nature without losing the rigor that comes from specialization, without losing the depth. And it is a real challenge. I must say, it's a challenge for me putting the classes together, but it's also about your challenge. And it's up to you to think deeply about the ideas as opposed to just superficially. And the test of this challenge, whether we have lived up to the challenge or not, is will the class make a difference? Now, you'll certainly get enough material here. Now, I was interviewed this morning by for 15 minutes about the class. And he said, well, what do you say about this class? It has a reputation for being easy. It has a reputation for being a good class, but it's also considered easy. And I said, well, one, I explained to him about the idea of the simplicity of the other side of complexity, which I think we talked about. But the other thing that I said to him was, when you enjoy something, it's easy. So for people who love math and are taking, say, math, 21A, for them it's not easy in terms of they have to work hard, but it's certainly much easier than for a person who is taking math 1A just for pre-med requirements but actually hates math, the most difficult thing in the world. So difficulty is often determined by levels of interest. So if it is more interesting, it will also seem easier. At the same time, I don't want us to forget about the danger, which is loss of rigor that comes from interdisciplinary approach. Second premise. As I said before, I wouldn't be teaching this class if I didn't think change was not possible. And this may seem trivial to some people. Well, of course change is possible. Well, it's not trivial for psychologists. For many psychologists believe that there is a base level of happiness that we've been endowed with, either because of our experiences early on, before the age of 3, or because of genetic endowment. Some people are just predisposed to be happier. And it's true, genes do make a lot of difference. But not all the difference. Most of the difference is up for grabs. Most of the variance, to put it in statistical terms. But as I said, there are studies that would argue otherwise. The most famous of them was done on human twins. The Minnesota twin studies. This is a study reported by Lycan and Telligan in 1996, but it's a study that has been running for many years. And the study is very smart, because if you want to see how much of the variance can be attributed to genes versus the environment, all you need to do is take identical twins, monozygotic twins, and look at twins who were reared apart. And there are enough of them around the world for a serious study. In other words, let's say I have an identical twin, exactly the same genes, but I was brought up in Israel, and my identical twin was brought up in Saudi Arabia. Unlikely, but let's say. Or people brought up in the US versus others in Europe, or Asia, and the identical twin brought up in this country. Interesting, right? Same genes, very different upbringing. And here is what Lycan and Telligan found. What they found was that the identical twins on personality measures, and specifically the one they were interested in was happiness, there was no significant difference in the sample in terms of happiness levels. And this was the last line, the conclusion of their study that was then reported throughout the world at the time. It may be that trying to be happier is as futile as trying to be taller and is therefore counterproductive. Serious stuff. I mean, they're not just saying that you can't change your happiness. They're saying that it may hurt you if you try to change your happiness. Why? Because it would be like saying, you know, grow taller, grow taller, grow taller. Believe me, if it worked, I would have been much taller today. It doesn't. But it leads to frustration, right? Because it doesn't work. So this is what they're saying about happiness. We're predisposed, even before the age of three, they're saying these are twins split at birth. And these are serious researchers writing about this. So is that true? So is change not possible? Well, fortunately, change is possible. I know you were tense there for a minute, but don't worry, it is. Now, how do we know that? You see, the study on the twins and various other studies that argued a similar thing are misleading. Why are they misleading? Because there is counter evidence. There is counter evidence that people change through therapy. Very rigorous, long-term research that shows that people actually change significantly. There is research that shows that people change after reading a book that has an impact on them. That people change as a result of a very powerful experience, positive or negative. And we'll talk about these peak experiences later on in the semester. In fact, I'm going to devote two lectures to change because it is such an important topic. I just want to introduce it now. So there is evidence that shows that a single sentence has changed an entire life. So a kid, for example, hears a sentence from a teacher that then sticks with her and transforms and her entire life looks different as a result of the sentence. People do change. Levels of happiness do change. But that's a problem. Wait a minute. What about that research then? Well, what the research does is make a very common error within psychology, within the social sciences, which is the error of the average. What's the error of the average? What did the researchers do when they studied the twins split apart? They took, can't remember what the sample size was, but let's say 200 twins from around the world. They put in their happiness scores of one set of twins on the other. They looked at the correlations, and then they averaged it. And what they found that on average, there was no significant change. Now, does that mean that all the twins had identical levels of happiness? Absolutely not. There were twins where one was unhappy and one was very happy in this sample. But that result became, again, to use statistical terms, it became noise. It became the error. They didn't look at that. They were the outliers. Remember the term from psych, from Stats 100, the outliers. And they were ignored, essentially, because of the average. But that's a mistake. You know, there's a joke told about the statistician who drowned in a pool because his friends told him that the average depth of the pool was 10 inches. Right? You can't gauge the height of the pool just because the average is 10 inches. Similarly with individuals, you can't gauge the potential of individuals just by going by the average. So even if the average says, and the average does say that people don't change, most people don't change. The fact that some people do proves the rule. The question is no longer, is it possible to change? If one person changes, it is already possible to change. The question then becomes, how is it possible to change? You know what the problem is with this research? Research by Lycan and Telegin and other people who argue that happiness is a fixed lot that we cannot change? Is that it hurts people. Imagine this. A 12-year-old girl, Texas, reads the local newspaper, and in the local newspaper, they report, they talk about the research by Telegin and Lycan. And she reads, she's depressed at the time, she's going through a very difficult period, and she reads that happiness is fixed, that one cannot change one's level of happiness because it's predetermined by your genes. What thoughts go through her mind, depressed, as she's reading this study? And it's done by serious people, by serious academics. So, you know, these are authority figures for her, you know, professors. How likely is she to overcome her depression, having just read that? You see, the problem with a lot of this research is that it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and not in the positive direction, because what Marva Collins does is also becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, but in the negative direction, where people start to believe that they cannot change, that their lot is fixed, that their misery, in many cases, is fixed. Now, if it were true, that's one thing, but it's not, and that's detrimental. You see, a lot of the ideas, and going back to something we spoke about earlier, a lot of the ideas within psychology, the research doesn't deliver good news, necessarily. Here, the news that it delivers is that it's very hard to change. You know, I would have much liked to hear that it's very easy to change, much better news. Or it would be much better news if research told us that all you need to do in order to resolve conflict is get everyone together. You know, at Harvard, bring the Republican Club, the Democratic Club, put them in Sanders, and by the end of 1504, they'll love each other. It's probably not going to happen. It takes more than that. Also, it would have been much better news that if had it been that all you needed to do in order to increase someone's self-esteem is to tell them how wonderful they are. I wouldn't need to be teaching this class. Or actually, I would be teaching it, but I wouldn't need to prepare my lectures. I would sit down here and say, you're wonderful, you're wonderful, you're wonderful, you're wonderful, you know, 800 times. Would have been much easier. But that's not what research shows us. So research doesn't always deliver good news. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't take it into consideration. You know, imagine an engineer who says, you know what? The law of gravity, you know that law of gravity? It really makes designing an airplane much more difficult. I don't like that law of gravity. I'm just going to design an airplane without the law of gravity. You know, not taking that into consideration. Hopeless, right? The same here. We cannot just say, just because it's difficult, we're going to ignore it. Just because change is difficult doesn't mean it's impossible. The question is how. And again, this is one of the main questions in this class. How we're going to do it? We're going to do it by studying the best. We're going to do it by studying the exception that proves the rule, the exception within ourselves and the exception outside. Let me explain. You see, this class takes two different approaches. One way that it's different is that it's positive psychology. It will focus on positive psychological research mostly. Yes, I'll talk about psychopathology, but mostly positive psychology. The second way in which it's different is that not only will it study positive psychology, it will also study the best within people, as opposed to the average. And in studying the best, I will draw on work done by Abraham Maslow, whom you're reading. What Abraham Maslow said is that the research that we need to focus on is not just the average, we need to focus on the elite. We need to focus on the exceptional. And the word that he used was growing tip statistic. Let me quote him in length. What this kind of research design means is a change in our conception of statistics, and especially of sampling theory, who we look at. What I'm frankly espousing here is what I've been calling growing tip statistics, taking my title from the fact that it is at the growing tip of a plant that the greatest genetic action takes place. Studying the best in ourselves and in others. He continues. If we want to know how fast a human being can run, then it is no use to average out the speed of a good sample of the population. It is far better to collect Olympic gold medal winners and see how well they can do. If we want to know the possibilities for spiritual growth, value growth, or moral development in human beings, then I maintain that we can learn most by studying our most moral, ethical, or saintly people. On the whole, I think it is fair to say that human history is a record of the ways in which human nature has been sold short. The highest possibilities of human nature have practically always been underrated. Certainly, it seems more and more clear that what we call normal in psychology is really a psychopathology of the average, so undramatic and so widely spread that we don't even notice it ordinarily. Can you see the implications of what he's saying? This was written in the 1950s. You want to make a better world? You want to have better people? Study the best. But there's a problem. There's a caveat here. Something is not quite right. Yeah, it makes sense what he's saying. You know, I wouldn't study the average runner to know how fast human beings can run. But I don't know, it sounds elitist. What do you mean to study just the best? I want to study the average. I want to study the masses. I want to study the common people. Well, there are two responses to this. First of all, it certainly doesn't exclude studying the average. Again, all I'm doing here is I'm saying the pendulum has shifted. We're only studying the average. What I'm saying is let's move the pendulum a little bit more toward studying the best extreme so that we can find a happy medium. So we can still study the average. The second thing I'm saying here, and the second reason why it is important to study the best, is because ultimately everyone benefits by studying. Everyone, the average, the common person, the person, the bottom of the pack, all benefit from studying the peak. Now it's related, those of you taking 1508, to the article by Du Bois on the talented 10th. Everyone benefits ultimately. Can you imagine if we didn't have the study of resilience, if all we studied in inner cities were the average students? What's the average? The average student fails. But instead, what people asking the question about resilience, remember the question? What about those people who succeed despite the negative circumstances? And when they asked this question about the select few, they were able to learn things that then applied to everyone else in inner cities. Studying the best, applying it to the rest. Or if you want to study great teaching or teaching, would you go to the average teacher or would you go to Marva Collins and learn from her or from people like her and then apply it to everyone else? Or a study of meditation, if you wanted to study meditation, would you take a random sample from this class, or would you go to Tibet, to a monastery, and study the best? Well, what we'll see when we talk about meditation is that this is exactly what researchers did. They brought meditators who had been meditating for 20 years, put them in an fMRI, studied their brain, and learned things that they then applied to the common person. I participated in a program based on that research. It was phenomenal. They would never have come up with these ideas had they not studied the tip of the stem. Or how about the study of relationships? Can you imagine if poets or researchers or philosophers had studied the average relationship human history? The average relationship, I'm sorry to say, is where the woman was subjugated. That's the average relationship throughout history. What if people had just studied that? But then came John Stuart Mill and studied an exceptional relationship, his own. And there were other people who studied exceptional relationships. And now we have a different norm as a result in our culture, as a result of studying the best versus studying the average. We also need to study our personal best, not just other people's best. We've all, each and every person, just like we've all experienced anxiety and depression and feeling down, we've all experienced peak experiences. We've all been ecstatic. We've all had periods in our lives when we were very happy. What can we learn from these periods? Why are we constantly obsessing about the time when I was depressed or the fact that I'm depressed now? Why not learn from these experiences, from the tip of the stem in terms of our own experiences, and then apply? So what did I do then when I was really happy? Well, I participated in extracurricular activities. I worked with people. Oh, well, maybe I can apply it to the rest of my life. Maybe when I look for a career, for a calling, I can ask myself, when was I at my best? When was I at my happiest? And from that sample, say, all right, now let me apply it to the present. You see, the difference between studying the average and studying the best is that the average describes. It will describe what my life as a whole is. It will describe what relationships have been throughout history. It will describe what the average teacher does or what the average student goes through in an inner city. It doesn't prescribe. Studying the best prescribes. This is when we become, when we study the best, the scribes in our lives. When we determine what our future is. Abraham Maslow, few in number though they be, we can learn a great deal about values from the direct study of these highly evolved, most mature, psychologically healthiest individuals, and from the study of the peak moments of average individuals, moments in which they become transiently self-actualized, whether it's by studying people whom we consider great, whether it's from literature, actual people, biographies, our parents, friends, or by studying the best in ourselves too. All right, so we talked about personal change, and we'll talk much more about it, but what about changing the world? Can we change the world? Because there are studies that question that. Let me share with you a study, one of the most comprehensive, best-run studies in the history of psychology. This was run back in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. Actually, it was run over 40 years. And what the study did was right here, run by Professor Cabot, who was here in the 1930s, a psychiatrist. And it was an intervention program for inner city kids right here. And here is what the study did. It was a 5-year intervention with a 40-year follow-up. And what the intervention was, twice a month a caseworker visited your house, would help you whether you needed help with family issues, psychological help, whatever help you needed. This is in many ways the dream study of all psychologists. Almost unlimited resources. 250 kids going through that study. They had academic tutoring, all these kids, you know, all the things that we're talking about with PBHA and what we're doing. They had it all, these kids. Psychiatric attention, the best doctors Harvard and MIT could find participated in this study. The kids were encouraged to be part of Boy Scouts and YMCA and other youth organizations. Again, a dream study, one which every psychologist would want to have. It wasn't just a great study, also the methodology was the best. As I mentioned, it was a random assignment, so there were 250 other kids who did not get the treatment that these kids did. Just randomly picked from the same population exactly. 40-year follow-up. Again, can you imagine the resources that went into this study? And yet the results were shocking. Even though the caseworkers, the psychiatrists, everyone involved in this study would praise this study to the hilt. Everyone said, wonderful, the best thing ever. The results didn't quite pan out. In terms of juvenile offenses, let me read you some of the results. 1/3 of those studied and the control group, no difference, had an official criminal record. 20% more had unofficial criminal records. Between 15 and 20% of these kids, when they became adults, between 15 and 20% committed serious offenses, either against people or against property. No difference. Also, no difference on health, mortality, and well-being, and other good psychological characteristics and measures. No difference, despite this incredible intervention. But there was a significant difference on alcoholism and job status in terms of finding better jobs, in terms of better education, and so on. Good, right? Terrible. The difference was in the wrong direction. Do you get it? So the control group, those that didn't get any intervention, were actually more likely to get a higher status job, and they were less likely to be alcoholic 40 years down the line. Unfathomable. Millions and millions of dollars, the best minds in the world put together to intervene, and these are the results? More alcoholism and less likely to find a good job? This startled the psychology field. So is society, on a grand scale, I'm talking now, societal change possible? Should we just, you know, be hands off? Because an intervention, it seems, can harm more than it do good, more than to do good. Well, once again, it doesn't always mean if you have more resources, you do better. The exception proves the rule. There are studies, there are individuals who make a lot of difference. The problem is that there are not enough practical idealists out there who know what actually makes a difference. There are programs for self-esteem enhancement that actually work, that have been applied in some inner cities. There are certain teachers who know about these things, who apply these things, who make a difference. Now, why didn't the study work? The Cambridge Somerville, I mean, there are many reasons. One reason is because I think the kids got a sense of entitlement rather than getting what Marva Collins would have given them, which is tough love. It's all up to you, as opposed to you deserve all this help, and they became spoiled. Another thing that they should have done, they should have made them work harder. Remember the self-esteem research? So it's out there, the research, but not enough people know about it. And more money continues to be poured in, very often to the wrong places. Creating, instead of active agents, passive victims. Idealism, good intentions are not enough. You know, I talked about the Happiness Center. Well, there are a few, too few, around the country, a few centers that are concerned with this, practical idealists who are united, who talk about how can we make large-scale difference. Abraham Maslow had a similar project in mind. He said, what I'm suggesting is Manhattan Project-type attacks upon what I consider to be the truly big problems of our time, not only for psychology, but for all human beings with any sense of historical urgency. The Manhattan Project, you know, arguably the greatest scientific joint project in history, where the greatest scientists like Szilard, Fermi, Bohr, and under the tutorship, the guidance of Oppenheimer, got together to create the atomic bomb before the Nazis would create it back in the 1940s. So what he's saying is that we need a similar project with the greatest mind, the best minds, to get together and to think about these big problems, these ideas, to think about scientifically, rigorously, not just within one discipline, but from all disciplines, and to come up with solutions to our biggest problems. But then what if I don't want to be part of this? What if I don't want to be part of this Manhattan-type project? What if I'm an individualist? Or what if I don't want to go into academia or into any of these organizations? Can I still make a difference? The answer is an absolute yes. All history is a record of the power of minorities and of minorities of one. The anthropologist Margaret Mead never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has. Individuals can, individuals do, make a difference. But you know, there is an issue here. And you know what the issue is? That most people don't believe that they can. Why not? Because they don't understand the process by which change occurs. See, they don't understand that human networks are exponential. This is how change occurs. Let me give you an example. Let's take smiles. Smiles, we know, are contagious. Now, let's say if you decide to smile, and you say, I'm going to smile at three people, and because smiles are contagious, this is why I chose the example, these three people are going to smile back, and they're going to think, well, we're going to smile at three other people, different people. And the three that they smile at will smile at three other people. How many degrees of separation do you think are there between you and the rest of humanity? So 1 degree would be the three people that you're smiling at. Were just smiling back at me, thank you. 800 of them. And then you go to three others, and they go to three others. How many, so this is 1 degree of separation, 2 degrees of three. How many degrees of separation to get to everyone in throughout the world? 20. After 20 degrees of separation, you get to every single person of the world if everyone smiles at three different people. Why? Because 3 to the power of 20 is over 3.5 billion. Times that by 2 in terms of the total number of people. It's an exponential function. You know, I chose smiles, but if smiles don't work, how about laughing at three people? With three people, I meant. Like this.
A ver cuánto tiempo aguantas sin reír.
All right. Sorry, I got to see this again.
A ver cuánto tiempo aguantas sin reír.
Too much. I'll post the URL for this. This is phenomenal. You, So send this to 3 people and ask them to send it to 3 others. Or how about paying a compliment, a genuine compliment, to 3 people? How many, do we do that? I don't think we do it enough. Because a genuine compliment, again, not just frivolous one, but a genuine one really makes us feel better about ourselves. And then if we do it to others, they feel better about themselves, and they communicated it on, and they pass it on and on and on. One person can make a lot of difference. This is the idea behind the butterfly effect, right? That a butterfly flapping its wings on one side can cause a tornado on the other side of the world. This is how social relation networks grow exponentially. I have a deal to make with anyone here in this room. I'm willing to give you $1,000 every single day for the next 30 days. All I'm asking in return is on the first day today, 1 penny, tomorrow, 2 pennies, the next day, 4 pennies, and then 8 pennies, and so on, only for 30 days. Anyone, and every day I give you $1,000. Anyone want to make that deal with me? I tried every year, it never works. These are Harvard students, that's why. Well, if you did take on this deal with me, I would have paid you $30,000, right, which is a lot of money. You would have paid me on the 30th day, so you would need to double it for the total. On the 30th day, you would be paying me $5,368,709.12. Exactly. Double that, so over $10 million. Or do you know the story of the inventor of the chessboard? You know, it was invented, so the story goes, was invented in India, and the leader called the inventor and said to him, you know, what would you want in return for this great invention, this great game? And he said, well, all I want is 1 grain of rice on the first box of the chessboard, 2 grains of rice on the second, 4 on the third, 8 on the fourth, and so on. That's all I'm. And the ruler said, are you sure that's all you want? You know, this is an amazing game. And he said, that's all I want. Well, when they started to count and calculate it, they found out that the amount of rice that he asked for would cover the entire earth. Yeah, this is the exponential function. Or how about this piece of paper? Let's take this piece of paper. How many times do you think I would need to roll it over in order for it to be high enough, pieces of paper, you know, into 2, into 4, into 8? How many times would I need to roll it over in order for it to be tall enough to reach the moon? That's 280,000 miles. 280,000 miles. How many times do I need to fold one piece of paper, which is 0.01 inches, I think? 0.01 inches. How many times do I need to fold it over? Math 55, anyone? 41 times. If I fold it 41 times, it will be tall enough to reach the moon. You can try it. You see, we underestimate our capacity to affect change because we underestimate the growth of an exponential function. And when we underestimate our capacity, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because we say, who am I to make a difference? Who am I to change? You're an entire world, and you can affect the entire world. I want to end by showing you an excerpt, a video clip from one of my favorite movies. Many of you know it. Pay It Forward. It captures in many ways the idea behind this course. I want to show you the trailer for those of you who haven't seen it. The trailer for this movie that talks about the exponential function. So just to remind you, what is this? Just bear with me. It's 2 more minutes. Bear with me. What this movie is about, basically the kids were given a class project to make a difference. And here is the project that one of the kids came up with.
It's just a big disappointment. Unless you take the things that you don't like about this world and you flip them upside down, and you can start that today.
That's me, and that's three people, and I'm going to help them. Then they do it for three other people, then they do it for three more. But it has to be something really big, something they can't do by themselves.
Lost your car?
That's a keen observation.
I can help you.
You're giving me a brand new Jaguar and you don't want anything?
Call it generosity between two strangers.
What did you tell my son to make him bring a homeless man into my house?
I've got a story, okay? Senior partner Channing and Moss is giving away new cars.
Just pay it forward. Three big favors for three other people.
Hello. You can't just put two people together and make them like each other.
This is the one.
Pay it forward. Paying it forward. It's like this idea.
You can fix a person.
Do you want to come in and stay?
It's complicated.
Come in.
It's supposed to be something hard.
I don't care about your burns, Eugene, if that's even what they are. Is that what they are?
I can't. I'm so sorry.
Don't tell me how sorry you are for me!
Maybe you're scared to get rejected. Well, I can't reject you. You're too quick for me.
Are you still gonna pay it forward? Give her another chance. For me. Are you wearing this?
No, I want to wear the cream dress.
No, you smell good.
Are you sure?
Yeah, yeah.
Pay it forward, the movement, it's reached L.A., Mrs. McKinney.
Come on, the movement?
So you'll, like, flunk us if we don't change the world.
But you might just squeak by with a seat.
Well, no great inflation in that school. Go forth, go paid forward. I'll see you next week. Thank you. Yeah.
Hey guys, before you take off, first of all, congratulations. This is the largest psych class in Harvard history, so congratulations to Tal. Yeah. It's really amazing, but before 830 of you send me more emails, sectioning will take place next week. We're in anticipating this, so it'll take place next week online, and I'll send an email to all of you giving you further instructions. Good night.